One of my favorite novelists, Scott Spencer, has a new book called A Ship Made of Paper. In this novel, as in his best-known novel, Endless Love, Spencer writes about romantic love that turns into obsession and threatens to destroy everything around it. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, writes, "Though the love stories Spencer writes about are typically out of control, his writing never is. He's such a precise and lyrical writer that feelings, experienced but possibly never expressed in language before, materialize in his words." The story is about two couples, one white, one African-American. The white couple, Daniel and Kate, pride themselves on their moderation in everything, until Daniel falls in love with Iris, an African-American woman who is married and has a child. The book considers his obsessive love from the point of view of all four adult characters. Here's what Kate has to say after sensing Daniel is attracted to another woman.
"People think that love is what's best in each of us, our capacity to love, our need for love. They think love is like God, and they worship their own feelings of love, which is really just narcissism masquerading as spirituality. You understand? If we say that God is love, then we can say that love is God, and that gives us the right to all these chaotic, needy, lusting, insane feelings inside of ourselves. We can call it love, and from there it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to calling it God. But here's a thought. What if God isn't love, and love isn't God? What if all those emotions we call love turn out to be what's really worst in us? What if it's all the firings of the foulest, most primitive part of the back brain? What if it's just as savage and selfish as rage or greed or lust? Love has become some insane substitute for religion. I think that's what's happened. And in this country, it's pounded in on us at all times, every radio station, every TV station, all the magazines, all the ads, everywhere. It's like living in a theocracy. It's like living in Jordan, and people are shouting out lines from the Quran from the top of every mosque. Love, love, love. But what they're really saying is, take what you want, and the hell with everything else."
So that's one point of view about love, that love can actually be very selfish and greedy. And that's expressed by Kate and Daniel, her longtime lover, who is now having an affair with another woman. He feels like he can sacrifice and should sacrifice everything for love, and that he's justified in doing that. And he also knows that one of the things going against him is that not only is he in a relationship, but his lover is married and she has a child. And also, she's African-American and he's white. And he knows that a lot of people will say that history is against them, but that doesn't matter to him. Let me ask you to read what he has to say about that.
"So will that be the contest? History in one corner and love in the other? Fine. Ring the bell. Let the fight begin. Love, he thinks, will bring history to its knees."
What made you think about writing about love from these two opposing point of views? You know, the point of view of like sacrificing everything for it, and the other point of view that it's really selfish and greedy to do that.
When I was writing this book, I really wanted to keep faith with all the characters in it. And I could not imagine this book and the progress of the book toward the consummation of an affair without also imagining how it was going to affect the other characters. And Kate in particular seemed to be the voice that most could express the emotions of the people who get left behind in these moments of emotional explosion. And it just seemed that that the story would be incomplete if you just followed the ardor of the situation. And I think that, you know, I wrote a book, Endless Love, in which I did follow just the ardor of the situation. And this is 20 years later, and I've become more interested in the other side of that at this point in my life.
In the consequences.
In the consequences and in the pain of it. I mean, I still feel the exhilaration of it, but I've seen the pain of it too closely to leave it out of the story.
Your new novel, A Ship Made of Paper, and your earlier novel, Endless Love, are about a certain type of love, a certain type of obsessive love. You're not only in love with someone, but your whole life kind of falls into the background as you pursue this passion. And in both novels, the character pursuing this passion kind of falls off the edge, and things around him just get inadvertently destroyed. What is your interest in that type of obsessive love?
Well, you know, Endless Love has been a blessing for me. I mean, it supported me as a writer for many years and supported my family for many years. And I sort of kept away from that subject for a long time because, you know, I don't want to become like the Barry White or the Johnny Mathis of literature. But the fact is, I do really enjoy writing about these things, the things that can be loosely categorized under the heading of love. But, you know, what some readers may choose to overlook, however, is that my view of this romantic and sexual impulse in my characters is always ambivalent. Like the hero of Endless Love, one reader pointed out to me, is, and I think quite correctly, is he's a stalker. And the protagonist in Waking the Dead only really loves his lover after she's disappeared, when she's literally been exploded. And Daniel Emerson in A Ship Made of Paper, part of his love for Iris Davenport is sort of shot through with a kind of annihilating naivete. And you know, even though he's willing to do anything in the world to be with her, he's willing to do damage to others, and he's also, I think, to his credit, willing to have damage done to him. So I become curious, you know, what is it? Is love an ennobling emotion, or is it somehow like a debasing emotion? And I come up with the answer that it's both. But it's also something else. It's that something that animates us. It lights the fuse that leads right to our explosive core. And I think I wanted to write about this now because I have like the good fortune to have love come back into my life at the unseemly age of 50-something. I began writing this novel when I began living with this writer named Joanne Beard, the essayist Joanne Beard, you know, who's not very much like the woman in this novel. She's white, she's from Illinois, and she's not like Iris at all. But falling in love with Joanne and living with her gave me the energy to throw myself into a story of heedless passion. And I figured, hey, why not?
Well, you know, stop me if this is too personal, but were either of you in the position of betraying a lover or a spouse in order to start this relationship?
We weren't. Thank goodness, no. No, we were both free and clear.
So in that sense, your love for each other wasn't endangering people around you?
No, but it just was reminding me of how much fun that is.
To fall in love, right?
To fall in love. No, putting people in harm's way is a nightmare.
One of the things I love about your writing is your kind of ease with analogies. They just are always so good and often so funny, and even when the sentiment that somebody's expressing isn't really funny at all, suddenly this like funny image will set in. After this long list of things that have gone wrong in Daniel's life, and then he concludes by saying that he's actually never been happier. He has this description of erotic love, which I'd like you to read.
Much of this happiness is purely physical. It is an animal joy, a stunning, erotic completeness such as he has never experienced. Daniel had always secretly believed that people who went on about their sexual happiness were exaggerating. They were like those restaurant reviewers who compare a bowl of soup to a glimpse of heaven. They were sexual gourmets. They were like those wine critics who justify their expense account indulgences with words that not only elevated their simple human pleasures into some bold adventure of the senses, but also claimed to be extracting arcane nuances of pleasures that only they could discern.
And Daniel realizes he has now become one of those people.
Yeah.
But I thought that analogy to like a certain type of food writer and wine critic was perfect, and also helped me crystallize what I don't like about a certain type of food writing and wine criticism. And I these analogies seem to just come to you. I bet you don't really struggle over them.
That's not the hard part of writing for me. That's not the hard part.
The hard part is what?
The hard part is getting people in and out of rooms, just making the story move in an interesting way, and the psychology of the characters.
A couple of your novels have been made into screenplays, and you've written some screenplays yourself. Was there ever any thought in the back of your mind as you were writing A Ship Made of Paper of maybe one day this will be a movie?
Well, this book took me well over 4 years to write, so I don't think there's any thought that didn't go through my mind.
You had plenty of time.
Maybe I would be canonized if, or would have to maybe go back to college, maybe perhaps go to law school or something. So I can't say that it never occurred to me, but it really it doesn't seem like a good thing to think when you're working on a book. It doesn't seem like a lucky thing to think. It doesn't seem like it would be good for the book, and I certainly didn't dwell on it.
There are a few things in the book plot-wise where it looks like, uh-oh, here's where the catastrophe happens. You know, here's where somebody dies or gets killed. And, you know, the things that could go wrong don't necessarily go, plenty goes wrong, but everything that could go wrong doesn't go wrong. Mm. And you back off from some near catastrophes, which gave me a sense of relief because I was afraid if all these things actually turned into catastrophe, it would be too much like a movie that was overplotted, or, you know, a movie that was overly dramatic in a way that life seldom is.
Right, right.
Did you consciously pull back from some of these things?
I think that I just was trying to stay within a reality that I could believe in.
Mm-hmm.
It's strange because we do live in a really violent world and a really upsetting world, you know. And I wrote a good portion of this novel after September 11th, 2001. And you know, like so many people, I reacted to that attack and to the carnage and to the destruction and the bravery of all the public sector workers and a lot of people I knew, especially your friends in the arts and writers in particular, began saying, "Gee, I can't even write after this. I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I can't do my work. My work doesn't seem important. It seems marginal." But the strange effect that had on me was that it actually had the opposite effect on me. It galvanized me. It really did. It was an act of violence and bread of hatred and blindness, and it seemed to me at that point there was just no better thing that I could be doing than to try to write a book and try to make art.
Why? Why did you reach that conclusion?
Well, partly because it's all I can do. I can't be a fireman. I don't know how to run into the building that's in flames, and I'm not a statesman, so I can't bring a peaceful solution to the world's conflicts. All I can do is tell the story and create characters who someone might care about, and you know, characters who show, you know, some of the fragility and irreplaceability of each human life. And it's all I could do. It's the thing I was trained for, is make a book, which is what I did. And it really did feel like a response, like it was my response to murder and war.
When it takes you 4 years to write a novel, how do you stop from losing confidence during those 4 years? It's such a long time. For me, I do a show every day. One show isn't very good. There's another one tomorrow. It's kind of like starting with a clean slate every day. The thought of a four-year-long project in which there's nothing that's complete until the end of that process, I would find that terrifying.
Well, I do find it pretty terrifying. And in the course of writing this particular book, I lost confidence in it quite a number of times. And again, I have the fortune of living with another writer who's really encouraging. And I don't know what I do to allow myself to keep going on. Sometimes I'll show pages to friends and they say, oh, that's very nice. And that gives me enough. And sometimes it's just the memory that this is what it's like when you're lost in the wilderness of a book and you just keep taking one little step after another and sooner or later you come out. And it's also, it doesn't always work out.
Right. You said that you write many drafts of your novels. What do you do with the early drafts? Do you burn them? Do you save them?
I recycle them.
What does that mean?
Well, I cannibalize them and take anything out of them that I want. And then I just get rid of it because I would just be living like a madman with tottering piles of paper everywhere.
Have you ever gone through like your old boxes of stuff that you never threw out from grade school and found something that you wrote when you were really young?
Yes. Yes.
What was it? What was your reaction to it? Did you think, wow, I was even good as a child, or did you feel the necessity of burning it to destroy the evidence?
Well, there's two things. I mean, what I found was letters that had been returned to me by people who no longer wanted to know me, and so I wasn't a child. I was like a high school student, and so I was. Got a packet on the back, like, oh, by the way, here's your letters. Don't ever call me again. And I read them, and so many of the things that I liked then, the cultural things that I liked then, are still the things that I like now. So I was sort of amazed that 35 years would pass, and I would make so few revisions in my taste, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's just how it is. And on a personal level, on a psychological level, I seem very, very hidden and a little pompous and uptight. Mm-hmm. So it was a little painful, but, I forgive myself for being self-protective because I was a kid.
What had you done that so alienated the people who returned the letters?
I don't know. What do I say? I give too much. I love too deeply.
Isn't it always that way?
It must be that.
Do you have like a process where you're going to write 2 hours a day, and every day you do that?
It's something like that. I start off pretty early in the morning, and I write until I've gotten a couple of pages written. Mm-hmm. So you can see what really it gives you a horrible glimpse of what the process is like, because I basically write 600-700 pages a year, and it takes 4 years to come up with 350 usable pages. But when in fact I've written probably 3,000 pages by that time.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever tried to change your way of writing? Have you ever said to yourself, well, I should write faster, or I should be able to write the first draft the first time and cut out the other three drafts, and that way I'd be more productive and it would be easier? Have you tried to go against your own nature to be that writer?
Absolutely. I'm going to try again, too. I'm going to try. I would love my next book to come out next year.
This is the kind of self-delusion that gets you through.
It is, but I also know it's not going to happen.
When you were a kid, did you write poems or stories?
Yeah, I did. I did. I wrote my first novel when I was 9 years old.
What was it about?
It was about a horse. It was about a horse who was forced into service in the German army. They're not in the North African desert, and escaped from the Nazis and was rescued by an American film crew that was making one of those Foreign Legion movies starring Buster Crabbe, and the horse galloped onto the set and they adopted it.
That's really funny. You certainly weren't following the old adage, write what you know.
No, that's what I knew. That's what I was allowed to talk about anyhow.
Well, why do you think you wrote, is that what you thought novels should be about?
Well, I suppose it reminded me a little bit of what I had read or what I wanted to read, and it seemed incredibly exciting to me.
It's funny how far you've come from that, since, you know, most of your fiction is so much about internal matters, you know, like adventures of the heart, not of like a horse who's scripted into the German army or whatever.
Yes. But if I do write that book, would you have me back on?
I'll have you read the whole thing out loud.
All right. This is the shot in the arm that I need.
After the fourth draft, you can come on.
I think as a kid, maybe this is a gender thing. I had no idea what my internal life was like, and as far as I'm concerned, I had none.
Huh? Weren't falling in love or locking yourself up in the room and thinking things you didn't want to share with other people and
falling in love, but not doing an awful lot of thinking.
Huh.
Not doing an awful lot of thinking.
That's odd, because your characters have pretty thorough internal lives. I mean, and especially the ones that are first-person narrators, they have to.
Well, yeah, but that came much later for me.
Mm-hmm.
That came... unless I've just forgotten it all, but I can't think of a thought that I had until I was 12 years old.
What changed when you were 12?
I don't know. I guess, you know, you go through physical changes. You start, I don't know what changed when I was 12.
Puberty made you introspective?
I think I just, puberty put me in contact with a better class of girl or something. I think that I'm one of those men who was really introduced to himself by girls.
That
my drive toward them finally led me back to myself, because that's what they were interested in.
You mean that they were interested in people as opposed to adventure, or
they were interested in people as opposed to adventure, exactly, and they were also interested in relating,
right,
on a more intimate and psychological way. And as far as I'm concerned, yeah, sure. You want to do that? I can do that.
Ever in psychotherapy?
No.
How would you feel about that as a writer?
Maybe I'm being too pedantic here. I mean, I've never had the full-blown psychotherapy. I've gone to see therapists, and, you know, and but it seemed a little casual, and I enjoyed it. I don't know. I don't think that it's damaging for a writer. I think that it's it's about making your life work more smoothly, which is probably good for a writer.
Right. Well, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's great talking to you, Terry, and thanks a lot for having me on.
Scott Spencer's new novel is called A Ship Made of Paper. Fred Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.